Chapter 5.
You'll forgive me, Mara said conversationally as she finished the last bit of wiring on her comm board, if I say that as a hideout, this place stinks.
Card shrugged as he hefted a sensor pack out of its box and set it down on the side table with an assortment of other equipment.
I agree, it's not Merkur, he said. On the other hand, it has its compensations. Who'd ever think of looking for a smuggler's nest in the middle of a swamp?
I'm not referring to the ship drop, Mara told him, reaching beneath her loose-flowing tunic sleeve to readjust the tiny blaster sheathed to her left forearm. I mean this place.
Ah, this place.
Card glanced out the window.
I don't know. A little public, perhaps, but that too has its compensations.
A little public?
Mara echoed, looking out the window herself at the neat row of cream-white buildings barely 5 meters away and the crowds of brightly clad humans and aliens hurrying along just outside.
You call this a little public?
Calm down, Mara, Card said. When the only viable places to live on a planet are a handful of deep valleys, of course things are going to get a bit crowded. The people here are used to it, and they've learned how to give each other a reasonable degree of privacy. Anyway, even if they wanted to snoop, it wouldn't do them much good.
Mirror glass won't stop a good sensor probe, Mara countered. And crowds mean cover for Imperial spies.
The Imperials have no idea where we are.
He paused and threw her an odd look.
Unless you know differently.
Mara turned away. So that was how it was going to be this time. Previous employers had reacted to her strange hunches with fear or anger or simple bald-faced hatred. Card, apparently, was going to go for polite exploitation.
I can't turn it on and off like a sensor pack, she growled over her shoulder.
Not anymore.
Ah,
Card said. The word implied he understood. The tone indicated otherwise.
Interesting. Is this a remnant of some previous Jedi training?
She turned to look at him.
Tell me about the ships.
He frowned.
Excuse me?
The ships, she repeated. The Capital warships that you were very careful not to tell Grand Admiral Thrawn about back when he visited us on Merkur. You promised to give me the details later. This is later.
He studied her, a slight smile creasing his lips.
All right, he said. Have you heard of the Katana fleet?
She had to search her memory.
That was the group also called the Dark Force, wasn't it? Something like 200 Dreadnought-class heavy cruisers that were lost about 10 years before the Clone Wars broke out. All the ships were fitted with some kind of new-style full-rig slave circuitry, and when the system malfunctioned, the whole fleet jumped to light-speed together and disappeared.
Nearly right, Card said. The Dreadnoughts of that era, in particular, were ridiculously crew-intensive ships, requiring upwards of 16,000 men each. The full-rig slave circuitry on the Katana ships cut that complement down to around 2,000.
Mara thought about the handful of Dreadnought cruisers she'd known.
Must have been an expensive conversion.
It was, Card nodded. Particularly since they played it as much for public relations as they did for pure military purposes. They redesigned the entire Dreadnought interior for the occasion, from the equipment and interior decor right down to the dark gray hull surfacing. That last was the origin of the nickname Dark Force. Incidentally, though there was some suggestion that it referred to the smaller number of interior lights a 2,000 crew ship would need. At any rate, it was the Old Republic's grand demonstration of how effective a slave-rigged fleet could be.
Mara snorted.
Some demonstration.
Agreed,
Card said dryly.
But the problem wasn't in the slave circuitry itself. The records are a little vague, suppressed by those in charge at the time, no doubt. But it appears that one or more of the fleet's crewers picked up a hive virus at one of the ports of call on their maiden voyage. It was spread throughout all 200 ships while in dormant state, which meant that when it suddenly flared up, it took down nearly everybody at once. Mara shivered. She'd heard of hive viruses leveling whole planetary populations in pre-Clone Wars days, before the medical science of the Old Republic and later the Empire had finally figured out how to deal with the things. So it killed the crews before they could get to help. Apparently in a matter of hours. Though that's just an educated guess, Card said. What turned the whole thing from a disaster into a debacle was the fact that this particular hive virus had the charming trait of driving its victims insane just before it killed them. The dying crewers lasted just long enough to slave their ships together, which meant that when the Katana command crew also went crazy and took off, the entire fleet went with them.
I remember now, Mara nodded slowly. That was supposedly what started the big movement toward decentralization and automated ship functions, away from big, all-powerful computers into hundreds of droids.
The movement was already on its way, but the Katana fiasco pretty well sealed the outcome, Card said. Anyway, the fleet disappeared somewhere into the depths of interstellar space and was never heard from again. It was a big news item for a while, with some of the less reverent members of the media making snide wordplays on the Dark Force name. And for a few years, it was considered a hot prospect by salvage teams who had more enthusiasm than good sense. Once it finally dawned on them just how much empty space was available in the galaxy to lose a couple hundred ships in, the flurry of interest ended. At any rate, the Old Republic soon had bigger problems on its hands. Aside from the occasional con artist who'd try to sell you a map of its location, you never hear about the fleet anymore.
Right.
It was, of course, obvious now where Card was going with this.
So how did you happen to find it?
Purely by accident, I assure you. In fact, it wasn't until several days afterward that I realized what exactly I'd found. I suspect none of the rest of the crew ever knew at all.
Card's gaze defocused, his eyes flattening with the memory.
It was just over 15 years ago, he said, his voice distant, the thumbs of his intertwined hands rubbing slowly against each other. I was working as navigator/sensor specialist for a small independent smuggling group. We'd rather botched a pickup and had to shoot our way past a pair of Karak cruisers on our way out. We made it all right, but since I hadn't had time to do a complete light speed calculation, we dropped back to real space a half light year out to recalculate. His lip twitched. Imagine our surprise when we discovered a pair of dreadnoughts waiting directly in our path.
Lying dead in space.
Card shook his head.
Actually, they weren't, which was what threw me for those first few days. From all appearances, the ship seemed to be fully functional, with both interior and running lights showing, and even a standby sensor scan in operation. Naturally, we assumed it was part of the group we just tangled with, and the captain made an emergency jump to light speed to get us out of there.
Not a good idea,
Mara murmured.
It seemed the lesser of two evils at the time, Card said grimly. As it turned out, we came close to being fatally wrong on that account. The ship hit the mass shadow of a large comet on the way out, blowing the main hyperdrive and nearly wrecking the rest of the ship on the spot. Five of our crew were killed in the collision, and another three died of injuries before we could limp back to civilization on the backup hyperdrive.
There was a moment of silence.
How many of you were left?
Mara asked at last. Card focused on her, his usual sardonic smile back on his face.
Or, in other words, who else might know about the fleet?
If you want to put it that way.
There were six of us left. As I said, though, I don't think any of the others realized what it was we'd found.
It was only when I went back to the sensor records and discovered that there were considerably more than just the two dreadnoughts in the area that I began to have my own suspicions.
And the records themselves?
I erased them, after memorizing the coordinates, of course.
Mara nodded.
You said this was 15 years ago?
That's right. Card nodded back. I've thought about going back and doing something with the ships, but I never had the time to do it properly. Unloading 200 dreadnoughts on the open market isn't something you rush into without a good deal of prior preparation. Even if you have markets for all of them, which has always been problematic.
Until now.
He cocked an eyebrow.
Are you suggesting I sell them to the Empire?
They're in the market for capital ships, she reminded him. And they're offering value plus 20%.
He cocked an eyebrow at her.
I thought you didn't much care for the Empire.
I don't, she retorted. What's the other option? Give them to the New Republic?
He held her gaze.
That might be more profitable in the long run.
Mara's left hand curled into a tight fist, her stomach churning with mixed feelings. To let the dreadnoughts fall into the hands of the New Republic, successor to the Rebel Alliance that had destroyed her life, was a hateful thought. But on the other hand, the Empire without the Emperor was only a pale shadow of its former self, hardly even worthy of the name anymore. It would be pearls before swine to give the Dark Force to them. Or would it? With a Grand Admiral in charge of the Imperial fleet again, perhaps there was now a chance for the Empire to regain some of its old glory. And if there was...
What are you going to do? She asked Card.
At the moment, nothing, Card said. It's the same problem we face with Skywalker, after all. The Empire will be swifter to exact vengeance if we go against them, but the New Republic looks more likely to win in the end. Giving Thrawn the Katana fleet would only delay the inevitable. The most prudent course right now is to stay neutral.
Except that giving Thrawn the dreadnoughts might get him off our exhaust trail, Mara pointed out. That would be worth the trade right there.
Card smiled faintly.
Oh, come now, Mara. The Grand Admiral may be a tactical genius, but he's hardly omniscient. He can't possibly have any idea where we are. And he certainly has more important things to do than spend his resources chasing us down.
I'm sure he does,
Mara agreed reluctantly.
But she couldn't help remembering how, even at the height of his power, and with 1,000 other concerns, the Emperor had still frequently taken the time to exact vengeance on someone who'd crossed him.
Beside her, the comm board buzzed, and Mara reached over to key the channel.
Yes?
Lacton.
A familiar voice came from the speaker.
Is Card around?
Right here, Card called, stepping to Mara's side. How's the camouflage work going?
We're about done,
Lacton said.
We ran short of flash netting, though. Do we have any more?
There's some at one of the dumps, Card told him. I'll send Mara to get it. Can you have someone come in to pick it up?
Sure, no problem. I'll send Danken. He hasn't got much to do at the moment anyway.
All right. The netting will be ready by the time he gets here.
Card gestured, and Mara keyed off the channel.
You know where the number 3 dump is? He asked her.
She nodded.
412 Waswashi Street, 3 blocks west and 2 north.
Right. He peered out the window. Unfortunately, it's still too early for repulsor lift vehicles to be on the streets. You'll have to walk.
That's all right,
Mara assured him. She felt like a little exercise anyway.
2 boxes be enough?
If you can handle that many, he told her,
looking her up and down as if making sure her outfit conformed to local Rishi standards of propriety. He needn't have bothered. One of the first rules the Emperor had drummed into her so long ago was to blend in as best she could with her surroundings.
If not, Lacton can probably make do with one. All right, I'll see you later.
Their townhouse was part of a row of similar structures, abutting one of the hundreds of little market areas that dotted the whole congested valley. For a moment, Mara stood in the entry alcove of their building, out of the busy flow of pedestrian traffic, and looked around her. Through the gaps between the nearest buildings, she could see the more distant parts of the city vale, most of it composed of the same cream-white stone so favored by the locals. In places, she could see all the way to the edge. A few small buildings perched precariously partway up the craggy mountains that rose sharply into the sky on all sides. Far up those mountains, she knew, lived loose avian tribes of native Rishi, who no doubt looked down in bemused disbelief at the strange creatures who had chosen the most uncomfortably hot and humid spots of their planet in which to live. Dropping her gaze from the mountains, Mara gave the immediate area a quick scan. Across the street were more townhouses. Between her and them was the usual flow of brightly clad pedestrians hurrying to and from the market area to the east. Reflexively, her eyes flicked across the townhouses, though with each window composed of mirror glass, there wasn't a lot for her to see. Also reflexively, she glanced across each of the narrow pedestrian alleyways between the buildings. Between two of them, back at the building's rear, where he was hardly visible, was the motionless figure of a man wearing a blue scarf and patterned green tunic, staring in her direction. Mara let her gaze drift on, as if she hadn't seen him, her heart thudding suddenly in her throat. Stepping out of the alcove, she turned east toward the market and joined the flow of traffic. She didn't stay with it long, though. As soon as she was out of the mysterious loiterer's line of sight, she began cutting her way across the flow, heading across the street toward the townhouse row. She reached it three buildings down from the loiterer, ducked into the alleyway, and hurried toward the rear. If he was indeed monitoring Card's place, there was a good chance she could take him from behind. She reached the rear of the buildings and circled around, only to find that her quarry had vanished. For a moment she stood there, looking around her for any sign of the man's whereabouts, wondering what to do now. There was none of the insistent tingling that had gotten them away from Merkur at the last second. But as she'd told Card, it wasn't a talent she could turn on and off. She looked down at the ground where the man had been standing. There were a few faint footprints in the thin coating of dust that had collected at the corner of the townhouse, giving the impression that the man had been there long enough to shuffle his feet a few times. A half dozen steps away, right in the center of another layer of dust, was a clear footprint pointing toward the west, behind the row of townhouses. Mara looked in that direction, feeling her lip twist. A deliberate lead-on. Obviously, footprints in dust never came out that clear and unsmudged unless carefully planted. And she was right. 100 meters directly ahead, strolling casually along the rear of the buildings toward a north-south street, was the man in the blue scarf and patterned tunic. A not very subtle invitation to follow him.
Okay, friend, she thought as she started off after him. You want to play? Let's play.
She had closed the gap between them to perhaps 90 meters when he reached the cross flow of traffic and turned north into it. Another clear invitation, this time to close the gap further lest she lose him. But Mara had no intention of taking him up on this one. She'd memorized the geography of the City Vale their first day here, and it was pretty obvious that his intention was to lead her up to the more sparsely populated industrial areas to the north, where presumably he could deal with her without the awkward presence of witnesses. If she could get there first, she might be able to turn things around on him. Double-checking the blaster beneath her left sleeve, she cut through an alley between the buildings to her right and headed north. The valley stretched for nearly 150 kilometers in a roughly east-west direction. But at this point, its north-south dimension was only a few kilometers. Mara kept up her pace,
continually revising her course to avoid crowds and other impediments. Gradually, the houses and shops began to give way to light industry, and finally, she judged she'd come far enough. If her quarry had kept with the leisurely pace of a man who didn't want to lose a tracker, she should now have enough time to prepare a little reception for him. There was, of course, always the possibility that he'd shifted to one of the other north-south streets somewhere along the way, changed direction east or west, or even doubled back completely and returned to Card's townhouse. But as she looked carefully around the corner of a building into the street he'd first turned onto, she discovered that his imagination was as limited as his surveillance technique. Halfway down the block, he was crouched motionless behind a row of storage barrels, with his back to her, his blue scarf thrown back out of the way across his patterned green tunic. Something that was probably a weapon, clutched ready in his hand. Waiting, no doubt, for her to stroll into his trap. Amateur, she thought, lip twisting in contempt. Watching him closely, not even bothering with her blaster, she eased around the corner and started silently toward him.
That's far enough,
a mocking voice said from behind her. Mara froze. The figure crouched by the barrels ahead of her didn't even twitch. And it was only then that she belatedly realized that it was far too still to be simply waiting in ambush. Far too still, for that matter, to even be alive. Slowly, keeping her arms stretched straight out to her sides, she turned around. The man facing her was of medium height, with a somewhat bulky build and dark, brooding eyes. His undertunic hung open to reveal a light armor vest beneath it. In his hand, of course, was a blaster.
"Well, well, well,"
he sneered.
"What we got here? About time you showed up. I was starting to think you'd gotten lost or something."
"Who are you?" Mara asked.
"Oh, no, Red. I'm the one what's asking the questions here. Not that I need to, of course. That fancy stuff on top pretty well tells me all I need to know."
He gestured with his blaster at her red-gold hair.
"Should have gotten rid of that. Hide it, or dyed it, you know. Dead giveaway. Pardon the expression."
Mara took a careful breath, forcing her muscles to unknot.
"What do you want with me?"
she asked, keeping her voice calm.
"Same thing every man real wants,"
he grinned slyly.
"A pile of hard gold cash."
She shook her head.
"In that case, I'm afraid you've picked the wrong person. I've only got about 50 on me."
He grinned even wider.
"Cute, Red. But you're wasting your time. I know who you are, all right. You and your pals are going to make me real rich. Come on, let's go."
Mara didn't move.
"Perhaps we can work a deal,"
she suggested, feeling a drop of sweat trickle down between her shoulder blades. She knew better than to be fooled by the other's careless speech and manner. Whoever and whatever he was, he knew exactly what he was doing. On the plus side, she still had the blaster hidden beneath her sleeve, and she would give long odds that her assailant wouldn't expect that a weapon that potent might be small enough to conceal there. The fact that he hadn't already searched her seemed to confirm that assessment. But whatever she was going to do, she had to do it now, while she was still facing him. Unfortunately, with her hands spread apart, there was no way for her to get at her weapon without telegraphing the movement. Somehow, she needed to distract him.
"A deal, huh?"
he asked lazily.
"What kind of deal you got in mind? What kind of deal do you want?"
she countered. If there'd been a box anywhere near her feet, she might have been able to scoop it up with her foot and throw it at him. But though there was a fair amount of junk littering the street in this part of town, nothing suitable was within reach. Her half-boots were firmly fastened around her ankles, impossible to get loose without him noticing. Rapidly, she ran through an inventory of items she was carrying or wearing. Nothing. But the Emperor's intensive training had included direct manipulation of the Force, as well as the long-range communication abilities that had been her primary value to his regime. Those skills had vanished at the moment of his death, reappearing only briefly and erratically in the years since then. But if the sensory tingles and hunches had started again, perhaps the power was back too. "I'm sure we can double whatever you've been offered," she said. "Maybe even throw in something extra to sweeten the pot?" His grin turned evil.
"That's a real generous offer, Red. Real generous. Lot of men jump on that right away, sure enough. Me."
He lifted the blaster a little higher.
"I like staying with a sure thing. Even if it means settling for half the money."
2 meters behind him, piled carelessly up against a retaining wall, was a small stack of scrap metal parts waiting to be picked up. A short length of shield tubing in particular seemed to be rather precariously positioned on one edge of a battered power cell case. Setting her teeth, clearing her thoughts as best she could, Mara reached her mind out toward the tubing.
"On my pad, half a sure thing's better than twice or nothing,"
the man said.
"Anyway, I don't expect you can outbid the Empire."
Mara swallowed. She suspected it from the first, but the confirmation still sent a shiver up her back.
"You might be surprised at our resources," she said.
The length of tubing twitched, rolled a couple of millimeters.
"Nah, don't think so,"
the other said easily.
"Come on, let's go."
Mara tilted a finger back toward the dead man crouched at the box behind her.
"You mind telling me first what happened here?"
Her assailant shrugged.
"What's the tale? I needed a decoy. He was a-wandering around the wrong place at the wrong time. End of story."
His grin suddenly vanished.
"Enough stolen. Turn around and start walking.
Unless you're looking to spite me by making me settle for the death fee instead."
"No," Mara murmured. She took a deep breath, straining with every bit of strength she possessed, knowing that this was her last best chance. And behind her captor, the tubing fell with a muffled clank onto the ground. He was good, all right. The tubing had hardly even finished its fall before he dropped to one knee, spinning around and spraying the area behind him with a splattering of quick cover fire as he searched for whoever was sneaking up on him. It took less than a second for him to recognize his mistake, and with another spray of blaster fire, he spun back again. But 1 second was all Mara needed. His desperate blaster spray was still tracking toward her when she shot him neatly in the head. For a long moment, she just stood there, breathing hard, muscles trembling with reaction. Then, glancing around to make sure no one was running to see what all the commotion was about, she holstered her weapon and knelt down beside him. There was, as she'd expected, precious little to find. An ID, probably forged, giving his name as Dengar Roth, a couple of spare power clips for his blaster, a backup vibroblade knife, a data card and data pad, and some working capital in both local and imperial currency. Stuffing the ID and data card into her tunic, she left the money and weapons where they were and got back to her feet.
"There's your twice of nothing,"
she muttered, looking down at the body.
"Enjoy it."
Her eyes shifted to the piece of shield tubing that had saved her life. She'd been right. The twitches of power, as well as the hunches, were back, which meant the dreams wouldn't be far behind. She swore under her breath. If they came, they came, and there was nothing much she could do except endure them. For the moment, she had other more pressing matters to deal with. Taking one final look around, she headed for home. Card and Danken were waiting when she arrived back at the townhouse, the latter all but pacing the floor in his nervousness.
"Hey, you all!"
he snapped as she slipped in through the back door.
"Where the blazes?"
"We've got trouble,"
Mara cut him off, handing the Dengar Roth ID to Card and brushing past them to the still largely disassembled communications room. Pushing aside a box of cables, she found a data pad and plugged in the card.
"What kind of trouble?"
Card asked, coming up behind her.
"The bounty hunter kind,"
Mara said, handing him the data pad. Neatly framed in the center of the display, under a large 20,000 was Card's face. "We're probably all in there," she told him. "Or at least as many as Grand Admiral Thrawn knew about."
"So, I'm worth 20,000 now," Card murmured, paging quickly through the card. "I'm flattered."
"Is that all you're going to say?" Mara demanded.
He looked at her. "What would you like me to say?"
he asked mildly.
"That you were right and I was wrong about the Empire's interest in us."
"I'm not interested in laying blame," she told him stiffly. "What I want to know is what we're going to do about it."
Card looked at the datapad again, a muscle tightening briefly in his jaw. "We're going to do the only prudent thing," he said. "Namely, retreat. Duncan, get on the secure comm and tell Lacton to start pulling the drop apart again. Then call Chin and his team and have them go over and repack this stuff in the equipment dumps. You can stay and help Mara and me here. I want to get off Rishi by midnight, if at all possible."
"Got it,"
Duncan said, already keying the encrypt codes into the comm board.
Card handed the datapad back to Mara.
"We'd better get busy."
She stopped him with a hand on his arm. "And what happens when we run out of backup bases?"
He locked eyes with her. "We don't give up the dreadnoughts under duress," he said, lowering his voice to just above a whisper. "Not to Thrawn, not to anyone else."
"We may have to," she pointed out.
His eyes hardened. "We may choose to," he corrected her. "We will never have to. Is that clear?" Mara grimaced to herself.
"Yes."
"Good." Card flicked a glance over her shoulder to where Duncan was speaking urgently into the comm. "We have a lot of work to do. Let's get to it." Mara would have bet that they couldn't reassemble their equipment in less than 24 hours. To her mild surprise, the crews had everything packed and ready to go barely an hour after local midnight. With suitably generous applications of funds to spaceport officials, they were off Rishi and to lightspeed an hour after that. And later that night, as the wild card drove through the mottled sky of hyperspace, the dreams started again.